6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome, everyone, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Mark. How are you today, Mark?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Very good. We're going to talk about the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago, then the games we played this week, then the topic. Because our end of the year is finally done, we've decided we're going to start a new project. It's going to span the next 641 episodes. We're going to do our top 10 alphabetically, but just so we get to cover them properly, we're going to do our own. So this, today, I'm going to do 100 to 90 in A, and then next week, Mark will do his 100 to 90 in A, and we'll go through A, the top 100 in A and through the letters, and then you'll say, well, why is it 100, 41? Because we'll have, at the very end, we'll have the big extravaganza episode where we do all the number and pronunciation games. So we'll do our own, like, sort of top 50, because that'll be a smaller category, right? And then that'll round us out to 641 episodes. So stay tuned for that. That's going to be fun.
I was not informed of this program.
Well, change. I didn't think you need to, because I'm doing my first 10 this week.
Your 100th favorite game starting with A?
Yes.
This is daunting. I think, Walker, I think recent trade wars have driven you off the bend. Now, you realize that, well, with the new tariffs, it doesn't mean that we have to produce 25% more content. You know that, right?
Well, I thought I'd just top it up just to make sure.
I have our legal gibbons, by the way, on the case about what we need to do with respect to the international trade war that's brewing between Canada, which is where we live, and the fine people of the United States of America. But
there are some things. For those people that wonder, apparently there's an $800 cap. So if it drops below $800, there's no tariff.
Yes, but the tariff is levied against the importers.
Yes.
So if you're importing $1,000 worth of 5-cent goods.
But so it won't hurt crowdfunding is what I'm trying to get at.
Won't it?
Because the value is under $800.
Is this per ticket price or overall value?
I'm pretty sure it's overall value.
Yeah, but if it's overall value, then anyway.
Well, suffice we can
to say,
hope.
That's one of the things. That's one of the terrible things about trade wars. The uncertainty confuses all the private actors and all the public actors involved. But anyway.
Well, that being said, they're just going to wait till everyone sort of gets established and figured out what it is, and then they'll end them. So that's
fair enough.
How it works.
Fair enough. That sounds like the timing.
So our actual topic is going to be how expansions can fail. Our Eurus, our as yet unnamed retrospective segment, is the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago, Mark. It was Undaunted Battle of Britain.
I adore Undaunted Battle of Britain. I've been very, very clear about that. It is a wild departure from a lot of the conventions that have stuck with all the other Undaunted games, including Callisto 2200, in that it is hex-based. It feels far more like a miniature skirmish game than the other ones do because of facing and a number of other factors. I think it's great. I don't have any particular enthusiasm for World War II aerial combat, but I really like the mechanisms and how it shakes up the formula. And, of course, this is a formula that I already adored.
I think I like it as probably my number one Undaunted. I like it much. I think I like it more than the basic Undaunted series.
It's tough for me. I may agree with you. It's really difficult because, again, it stands so different from all the other ones. And I really like the changes, but I also like the core system. I think in order to determine my favorite Undaunted, I'd have to sit down with the scenarios from all of them and use that as sort of the tiebreaker to determine.
Play more, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, playing more is always a good idea when it comes to the Undaunted series. So this is by the Undaunted designers, Trevor Benjamin and David Thompson, published by Osprey Games. All the Undaunteds are great. Can't really recommend them highly enough. I thought that the most recent 2200 was a bit of a misstep, but all the World War II ones thus far have been very, very interesting, and you cannot go wrong with starting with Normandy, but Battle of Britain does have a badass sick man on the cover, so that's definitely something to recommend it.
It's true.
So, onto the games we played last week. Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, you were nice enough to bring Malediction to the table. This is designed by Leo Cunha, Nicole Lobo, and Daniel Peterson to Lucena, and published by Loot Studios. So this is a crowdfunding that ended this day, which is Monday the 3rd of February. But much like all of the game founds, I'm sure you can late pledge. They did very much try to push it as a Magic the Gathering meets Warhammer. And I can see where they get that, you know, cooperation there. It's like heavy miniatures with magic card play. It's very much like Underworlds, where it's fairly small, skirmishy, boosted with your cards. Except, unlike Warhammer Underworlds, you don't have to keep summoning. You have to keep summoning your units. So you have a limited number of summoning cards in your deck. There's lots of spells that'll come through that you cycle that deck a little bit. There are spells that will boost up your units. And you line up your unit cards that you've summoned, and then you get to activate them in whatever order you want. And it's a nice straight-up activation combat system. There's lots to like about Malediction.
I was surprised by the extent to which the tabletop miniatures aspect was preserved. This is one of the big differentiating features between Malediction and other kinds of similar weight, I think, skirmish systems that are based on hexes or based on squares or what have you. It really is an analog, old-school style measure movement, measure the distance for effects. Now, most of the time, and indeed far too often, in such tabletop miniatures war game rule sets, the analog nature of the game doesn't come into play. And you might as well just sub it in for some sort of hex-based movement. And indeed, when you look at something like Heroescape, and you can convert a lot of miniatures games to Heroescape hex units and not lose much. But in the context of Malediction, a lot matters about being within an inch of one unit to be engaged with them, being an inch away from something else for not, being within the specific distance of a variety of ranged effects, be they attacks or buffs or what have you. And consequently, the positioning, the subtle positioning of units ended up being very, very consequential. I appreciate that a great deal. Another thing that I'm often worried about in the context of tabletop miniatures war games, which Malediction kind of suffers from and at the same time kind of doesn't, is the scrum. Very often what you have, especially if you have engagement rules and disengagement attacks, you end up with all your units just fighting in some sort of large cluster. And so when it comes time to activate, you're just whacking away at whatever target you're engaged with, because the alternative, the opportunity cost of doing anything else, of trying to reposition, of trying to engage in some sort of outmaneuvering, is simply too high. Malediction, definitely, the game we definitely had a scrum, but at the same time, because of some subtle interactions about A being engaged with B, and B and C being engaged with each other, but C not being engaged with A, it actually was very consequential, and I was very pleased with that interaction. And then you have some units that are almost exclusively there to give buffs, in the case of the faction that I was playing, which roughly corresponds to white in Magic the Gathering, and so I had to pay the opportunity cost to disengage. And so that all of that I very much appreciated. The interface between card play and miniatures was cool. There's also a really interesting aspect to the distribution and the retail model that Malediction is positing. You get a faction starter, which has everything you need. It's got terrain. Every faction has their own unique type of terrain that has different and very consequential effects on what happens to the units. Their own set of relics over which you'll be fighting, although there's a lot of duplication there. Their own units, etc., etc. But what they also have is standees for every possible unit, and you can download STL files to 3D print any of the units you want. And I really appreciate that that's a way to keep costs down. You're going to pay more than you would for just standees, but you're going to pay a lot less than you would pay for a box full of miniatures. And you can print out the miniatures you want and not print out the miniatures you don't want, because since there's deck construction, you get to pick and choose. And you could even have, you know, unpainted miniatures next to painted miniatures next to standees. It wouldn't look ideal, but it would look fine.
No, but like you said, you could print the leader, because every deck has leader, so you could print your one big leader. Yep. So that would look interesting. You'd have him on the table and then surrounded by standees. I don't think that would be too bad. To go back to how you said about the scrum and how the miniatures are all situated, and sometimes there's this weird blocking. They have this very, that I've never seen in a miniature game before. I forget what the actual name for it is, but I call it the shimmy. So you do this.
Yeah, we were calling it the shimmy. Yeah.
You do this particular move where it lets you, you know, weave your way through any space, but as long as they're not, you know, not base-to-base contact, and you get to come out the other side. It costs a lot of actions, but you get to do these maneuvers, which, you know, sort of breaks up this, you know, these giant blocking scrums that take up the whole battlefield.
Yeah, because you had very cleverly positioned your units both to aggressively claim territory and to prevent some of my units from being able to leave, because you have these big chunky bases and a unit can only move through if there's room for the entire base. Well, there wasn't a gap big enough. But if you take the move, which we here at Sovereign Republic Games affectionately call the shimmy, you can get through so long as you end in a valid space and there's at least any room between them. And yeah, it worked out surprisingly well in a number of contexts. So I have to say I'm very pleased with initial experiences with Malediction. Another thing that I'll just stress again from the retail distribution arm, for generations now in the hobby space, we have dealt with starters that are not starters. And the tabletop miniatures rule set space is rife with starters that are not starters. And I really appreciate that there's literally everything you need in a single box for your one faction. They're individual factions, so to play two players, you need two faction boxes. But the fact that there's all the terrain you need and there's all the standees you could possibly have, it's like the exhaustive list of available units. There are no boosters yet. I mean, there might well be going on if the product line continues. But as a start, you actually get everything you need at a reasonably good price, especially when you consider the alternatives in the tabletop miniature space. It's still going to be more expensive than a pile of rocks and a pile of Hot Wheels cards for Gaslands, but at least you don't need custom dice, and so it's a relatively low barrier to entry. And if you have a 3D printer, the barrier is yet lower. So I've appreciated a lot of what Malediction does. I should say that Malediction is a review copy we got from the publishers. It is up on crowdfunding now. You can late pledge on GameFound. There are four factions available as of now, but there's plans for a lot more stuff. And I've really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to trying more factions and playing some more. And my understanding was, Walker, that you had the same reaction.
I agree. And the models are very nice.
The art's very nice. The renders look nice.
Yes.
I have not seen myself any 3D printing. I might reach out to the Hunwerker and see if he's interested in printing out any of the miniatures. But as of yet, we've just been doing the standees. And frankly, the standees with cardboard terrain was fine.
Yeah.
So no objections there. That's Malediction by Leocona, Nicholas Lobo, and Daniel Peterson de Luna by Loot Studios. We concluded somewhat early our mini-campaign of Slay the Spire, the board game, because the Tier 2 boss done decapitated two of the people. So this was the boss that alternates between buffing itself up and doing large quantities of damage to the entire party. So very unceremoniously at the end of round 3 of fighting the boss, we declared, okay, and then the boss does 9 damage to everybody. And the two Louis were like, that's it.
Yeah, I don't have that much.
Yeah, they didn't have that much at all. Slay the Spire, the board game, was our game of the year for 2024. Absolutely no regrets. Would have happily gone on to level 3 of the campaign if we were so inclined, or at least so able. You know, the spirit is willing, but the flesh was weak. And
you should have went the totally different direction there. Since we lost, now I hate it, and I pull it off our list.
No. I'm not the Walker of this equation, Walker.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So we might end up starting another campaign right away next week. I don't know, because as I say, the one of the Louis is very enthusiastic about Slay the Spire, The computer game, and very much enjoyed the adaptation, but everyone involved loves the board game adaptation, so we might end up seeing more imminently. It's good to be able to get Game of the Year back to the table again, and looking forward to more experiences. I'm also, again, looking forward to Contention Games doing more stuff. So far, they've got two very interesting offerings, and I'm very curious about what the future holds for them. So this is Slay the Spire, the board game by Gary Dworetsky, Anthony Giovanetti, and Casey Yano, published by Contention Games, pursuant to successful crowdfunding last year.
So we had another review copy. This one's called Lone Wolves. This is put out by Wonderful World Board Games, and it's another very interesting take on a trick taker. It's a two-player only, and it's a little bit of smash-up style. You put out this board that has the five different suits that are sort of like landscapes, and then the players are going to start playing to those different areas, and you're only going to play one hand of 13 cards. So the way they try to balance this out is every time you lose a trick, there are these tokens that you can use to manipulate the different fields that either give you more points, make cards worth more in different ways. And the winner of the trick gets to use the total value of the card in which they won the trick with to add towards winning that field. The loser always flips their card over, and it's always a one on the other side, but they're using these tokens to manipulate the points to try to either, you know, win other fields or, you know, make that one better somehow. And I thought it was a very interesting take on trick taking, and I'm looking forward to playing it more. What do you think?
Broadly speaking, the field of the weird two-player trick-taking game, very often from Japan, as Lone Wolves was, this was designed by Yasuyuki Nakamura, has managed to capture some of the truly strange interactions of the hobby trick takers of about 20 years ago, but with a much simpler rule set. The amount of timing and trade-off consideration in Lone Wolves is genuinely impressive, given how parsimonious the rules load is and how quick it is to play. Because I would compare it to a little bit of Smash Up, a little bit of Shot and Totten, with trick-taking elements combined there, because you've got all these fields, the fields matter, you're competing over the fields. Sometimes you want to lose because you want to activate the token. Sometimes you want to play a card to a certain field, not because you care about what's happening about the field, because you want to lock down that field. Sometimes you want to play to a field, not because you care about any of that, because you want to make that field trump. And so it actually interacts with the rest of your hand. And so there's all these considerations, and all the while you still mostly want to win tricks because you want to keep those high-value cards face up. So somebody plays a card to a field, and you're like, okay, where do I play? Do I want to win this trick? Do I want to lose this trick? If I want to lose the trick, how do I want to lose it? It's really impressive, and the trade-offs are very, very pointed, very transparent, and involve a lot of moving parts while at the same time being very straightforward. It's very, very tense, and I was blown away by Lone Wolves.
Yeah, because like you said, with the trump, because the game starts out with no trump, and there's three tokens in every field, and when a field is devoid of tokens, then you put a moon token on that field. And like I said, the fields all represent the different suits. So now that suit is going to be trump until a second
field gets emptied.
And so that happened in the game. I wanted to play to this field, but if I played to that field, the loser would take the last token off, and therefore the trump would change. And I made the first trump for a reason, because I still had like four of that suit left in my hand. So it sort of forced me to play somewhere else so I could keep that trump for a little bit longer.
And similarly, I was really constrained by my ability to play to a number of fields to get those tokens that I wanted, because it would make trump something in a suit in which I was void. So it's like, okay, I'll just lose to, oh, I can't lose to there. Damn it. So I had already mentally identified that field as one I was going to lose, because it's an area majority game, not entirely unlike Shot and Totten to a large extent. It's like, all right, that's the field where I'm going to dump my garbage. Oh, wait, no, I can't dump garbage there. It'll make trump green, and I don't have any green. That's absurd. And again, like I said, you're setting up these things. It's one of those things where, and I'm very curious about how this is going to feel on subsequent plays, where because of that play you did three hands ago, you're really constrained in an unpleasant way. Unpleasant in terms of your options, but pleasant in terms of the tactical trade-offs you need to make. And so I'm curious if on future plays you get to see some of those ripple effects more early on. Because I was intrigued in the first few card plays, but I was doing things that had consequences that really come to bite you later on. And again, that's one of the reasons in which it, one of the ways in which it reminds me of Shot and Totten so much. You know, you make these a couple commitments, and then suddenly you're doomed.
Yep. And you can only have six cards per field. So that's yet another, you know, high risk, because like I can keep dumping cards in here, and then that will stop you know, that way my opponent cannot play any more cards there.
Yeah, and then suddenly, you've dumped garbage there, but you've dumped four pieces of garbage there. There's only room for two more cards there. I look over, and suddenly your dumping ground is going to win because I've left it too long.
Exactly.
Whereas if I'd committed to a couple of good cards, or even just some middling cards earlier, I wouldn't be in this predicament. It's supremely well done. Lone Wolves is very impressive.
And so they also do the cards go from 2 to 7, and so they've made it so that the 2 beats the 7, and the 3 also does a thing with the counters because some of them are hidden.
Eh.
And so lots of interesting things. That is Lone Wolves.
Finally showed Walker Massive Darkness 2 Hellscape. For a while, he's been talking about how he wanted to try it. I would make jokes about how it had already been sold. He would weep abjectly. I would laugh. Good times would be had by, shall we say, most. But we were in a position where we're at my house, so I don't have to transport the massiveness that is Massive Darkness 2. Got to play Massive Darkness 2. As I keep pointing out, in Massive Darkness 2 Hellscape, one of the chief virtues is how it does class differentiation. Everyone has a different little mini-game as far as how things are working. Walker's, if anything, was the most straightforward in the way that the sheer mechanics worked on the outset, because he was playing as a necromancer. As he gets experience points, he gets an equivalent number of soul points, and he just cashes in the soul points to reanimate things. At a base level, that's skeletons, but then later on, Walker, no joke, reanimated Beelzebub, who was following us around. So we had this undead, semi-rotting bug devil, like you do.
Yeah, like you do as a party in a dungeon.
Oh, it was a party, all right. Huey was a rogue who gets to play a bag-building game. I was a paladin. Paladins get to deploy these zones which give other party members buffs, which is awesome. And in addition, I finally played the character that I'd wanted to play for a long time, because one of the paladins actually gets to interact with the bag-building of the rogue. Now, this is one of those instances, and this is something we're going to talk about later in the context of expansions, where I'm really not sure that they spent a lot of time thinking about how this is going to interact, because one of two things is going to be the case. Either this character is going to be playing at the same time as there are no other rogues at the table, in which case, that's kind of weird because now you're just importing all this other material that wasn't going to be used before, but it's probably preferable to the way that we did it for balance reasons. I don't really care about balance in a co-op game like Massive Darkness 2, so it's not an issue. Where Huey is making the bag better as he levels up and is relying on certain tokens being there when he needs them, but suddenly I'm taking them at various times. And so it's not really like he loses them. They'll cycle through from the discards, but he was expecting to be able to have them on his go-round through the bag, but I end up sapping them, and sometimes that might involve my theoretically being able to poison things, which technically is not a thing that paladins get to do in Massive Darkness. Anyway, is it janky? A little bit. Does it work? Sure. Is it fun? Yes. And so I really, that's the primary drive for me in Massive Darkness 2. The way the different classes work, I just find it fun. It is a silly dice chucker. The challenge is way off. It can be way too hard at the early bits. Round about the mid-game, the difficulty gets flipped straight off and you're just going through the motions. But whatever, it's a dice chucker. I don't really have much to say about it.
Yeah, it was pretty, I thought it was too easy. It was pretty well the first room. We open up the door and there's some skeletons. Like, well, we can't really harm these skeletons. It's okay. Let's just jump over to this other room and grab some weapons. It's like, oh, okay, now we're going to kick butt through the whole thing. There's sometimes things would show up and I'd be looking at the cards. It's like, oh, that's a cool mechanic for monsters. I can't wait till it's my turn. Oh, they're all dead? I don't get to see them anymore? No problem. Okay, let's go. So, yeah, we after the first pull, we pretty well trashed the rest of the dungeon.
Yeah, it was a raffle stomp. Yeah, the difficulty is borderline non-existent. Now, in fairness, it was an early scenario, and sometimes in the Massive Darkness games, and I believe this is true of Massive Darkness 2, the later scenarios get a little bit more difficult. But quite frankly, I wasn't interested in dealing with some of the rather convoluted boss interactions that some of those scenarios introduce. So, admittedly, it might get slightly more difficult, but never really too particularly challenging.
True. It seems, though, when I think back, is that the monsters got a lot of weapon pulls as opposed to armor pulls. So they weren't that much more tough. So we could take them out quickly, and then therefore their attacks weren't as powerful, even though, you know, they had the bonus to their attacks.
Well, The problem, though, and this is, I think, just because of how shallow the Massive Darkness 2 design is, there's not a whole lot of things you can do against an enemy with high armor value. There's a small number of non-attack ways to deal damage. And so if it is the case, we encounter this during our first early attempts against Beelzebub before we geared up. If a starting enemy has a couple of defense dice, there's nothing you can do to scratch them. And so they're just going to keep harassing you until you find the necessary gear. And thankfully, I believe it was Huey's suggestion. It's like, no, let's just go pick up the gear first, and then we'll actually take care of this thing. And that was the right way to do it. I agree with you that more defense would make them more dangerous, but highly defended monsters in games of this ilk are just not fun. You're pitching dice. Oh, the result of my attack is nothing. Okay, the result of my attack is nothing.
True.
This isn't Guards of Atlantis. There's no interesting subtleties of interactions between its offense and defense. It's just, oh, their defense is too high. Boring, they're a brick wall.
That's Massive Darkness 2 Hellscape. Next up, I got to play Critter Kitchen. It's a new crowdfunding game that just came out by Cardboard Alchemy, designed by Alex Cutler and Peter C. Hayward. And it's very much in the ilk of Flamecraft. Same artist, same very cute puns. I was playing Goten Ramsay, was the name of my...
I see what they did there.
My chef. And it is a worker placement game where there's a bunch of different locations that have ingredients that you need to make the dishes. One will come up per round. So in the first round, you know what the first dish is going to be. There's going to be three dishes, 6 rounds for the game. So 3 dishes, then you make those 3 dishes, then another 3 dishes. You get to see 1 per round. You race around trying to get the ingredients. You have 3 workers, a fast one, a medium one, and a large one. And so the fast one can only get 1 ingredient, medium 2, large 3. But how it works is that you have a deck of cards, 1 for every location. So you program the actions where they're going to go. You reveal them, you put the workers out, and then all the quick workers go first. So there's a priority order, so they all take 1. And then the 2s go if they happen to be there. So you're just trying to get the good ingredients because they all have number values. And then you make your dishes, and then you score points based on, you know, how large of a number you got to with all the ingredients that you put into the dish. And at the very end of the game, there is a critic. You know from the beginning who the critic is. This is the one mechanic I purposely didn't involve myself with whatsoever.
Okay.
There's a critic. You get to see his special ability and what he wants. And he wants...
Critics are the worst. I hate them.
It's true. They're just so arrogant. They think they know everything. And they talk as though what you know, that their word is law and no other opinions
it's
matter.
It's just an opinion. It's just an opinion. Ah,
so you need critics. For the critics, you need 1 of every ingredient. But they have all these rumor cards. And in the bag of tokens that are all ingredients that you randomly put at the locations, there is symbols for the 3 different sort of rumors for that critic. And he could like wine or, you know, there's all these different things.
My understanding is that most critics like wine.
That are going to modify his score. And so I'm not. I decided I'm not going to interact with that at all. I don't care.
It's the purity of the art for you.
I don't care what he wants.
Yeah.
He's
going to eat what you give him.
What were some of the ones we wanted? If when you set up your little board that is 1 of every ingredient, if it's sort of ascending points, you'll get bonus points. If the other one was...
I believe they call that a progressive meal.
Progressive meal. If whoever has the most of the same number was another bonus. Anyway, a bunch of different bonuses you get for the critic. That's for the 7th round at the end. In all, I love the art. It's a much better game, I thought, than Flamecraft. I would definitely play it again.
Why did you ignore the critic? I'm just curious.
Well, it was just like, at the time, it was just, you know, because we streamed it. If you're interested, it was on the stream. When I'm streaming, it's just like, I'm doing the comments, I'm doing this. It was just the road too far. And,
got it.
And I just wanted to focus on getting, it became a bit halfway through, right? It's just like, I wanted to focus on getting the, because it's also a choice of ingredient. Right, when you go there and you win, you choose either the token to get the rumor or you take an ingredient.
Ah.
And I didn't want to give up taking the ingredient. And therefore, I think it very much loops into Race for the Galaxy, looking to see what's coming up. Almost probably the exact same feeling there.
It's
like, I'm just going to fall into whatever, you know, scoring categories that happen to come up. Anyway, sure. I will play Critter Kitchen again for sure. Very interesting, very cute. And it plays fairly quickly. 7 rounds, but it's, you know, everyone plans their turn. You put out the things, take the tokens. Next turn, plays very quickly.
Yeah, if you're going to be cute and whimsical, you might as well be fast and breezy, generally speaking. That was one of the things I wasn't a huge fan of with respect to Flamecraft. It was a little too long.
Hey, well, you're too busy moving tokens around.
Yeah.
Also got to play Coloretto. It's one of these things where you're on your way to game day and it's like, man, I haven't played Coloretto in a while. You grab it and you throw it in your pocket and you play at the end. It's a very interesting game where you put out three trucks and then on your turn you either draw a card and put it on a truck or you take a truck. I know they're not trucks in Coloretto, but they're trucks in Zuloretto, so we're going to call them trucks.
I was thinking, it's been a while since I played Coloretto. I do not remember trucks. My cards for you are like a truck, Walker.
So I think there's six or seven different suits in Coloretto, and you're only going to score for three. Anything beyond three is negative points. So you want some trucks, you don't want this. It's like push your luck, sort of like raw at the end. You know, when you're the only one left or there's only two people left, you know, do I keep filling the trucks up or do I take the hit?
I love the ability when pulling cards to look at a setup, a truck that is perfect for somebody else, and then just ruin it with just the absolute...
That's right.
It's one of the reasons why Raw is so elevated, right? The idea that suddenly what was great for you can become a poison pill because you stayed in too long. You should have pulled the trigger earlier. Yeah,
or you can just coach them to draw another one. It's like, that's going to be... You got to draw... That's going to be red. You need red. Next card's going to be red. They got brown. It's like one they did. It's fantastic. Anyway.
Yeah, Coloretto is very well done, yeah.
That's designed by Michael Schatt and published by Abeckerspiel. We got to play White Castle today with the Matcha expansion. I got to show Mark that. We hadn't played it in a while, or Mark hadn't played it in a while. It's a great game of dice drafting and trying to clear your board and get everyone into the castle. What'd you think of the new expansion, Mark?
So my recollection of White Castle, the OG White Castle, was indeed that it is very efficient. It's a very tight, quick Euro game. But I vaguely remembered that some of the placements, this wasn't my key opposition to White Castle, but I remembered that some of the placements felt a little forced near the end because there wasn't a whole heck of a lot to do. And I felt that the Matcha expansion, which adds another basically set of worker spaces to activate and another set of workers, which are the dice, really opens up the game to a very pleasant equilibrium. It doesn't feel like everything is super wide open. You feel that there are some things you really need to jump on before other people can. And White Castle has always been, you know, relatively solitaire-ish past the placement. But I felt that the Matcha expansion didn't really change the fundamental tenor of the game in an unpleasant way. Didn't add anything that felt super extraneous, but just recalibrated the balance of placement such that it was a little more open, and I very much appreciated that. It doesn't, I think, bloat White Castle past what it wants to be. It makes it longer, but when you're starting from something that's already super quick, you can make it longer without, I think, doing too much violence to the core design. Now, I should stress, I'm a relative neophyte when it comes to the White Castle. I've only played White Castle once or twice, and I've now just played Matcha the once. I needed to be reminded about how everything worked. I'm not a huge fan of the super combinatoric scoring. You know, your soldiers will score some points based on the number of courtiers you have, and then the new geishas, they score in turn based on some combination of the other things you've got. And so it all feels very dependent on everything else. I prefer the way just the basic courtier scoring works, where they're climbing up a ladder. I envision them as trying to pass civil service exams in the traditional way.
Slowly advancing towards the emperor. One sort of room or step at a time.
Yeah, every time they get another letter added to their degree at the end of their name, they get to sit a little bit closer to the emperor, and that's how it works. Or even the way the farmers work. I don't know. So the scoring doesn't excite me. What you're doing with the engine, I find relatively pedestrian, but your desperate attempt to cobble together these little, not particularly sprawling, but nonetheless satisfying combos with your dice placement, because the actions are so tight and the resources are relatively tight, I do find very pleasing. The overall engine of White Castle is really, really good, and I think it's improved by Matcha. I'm not super jazzed about what you're doing with it, which is not a huge criticism. As far as Euros go, seldom is it the case that you can get on board with the endgame scoring conditions to a tremendous extent. So I would happily play again. Now that I remember how the thing works, I would be very eager to go back to it, possibly both with and without the expansion, to get a better sense of comparison. Devir games, generally speaking, tend to be solid functional Euros. They don't quite grab me the way that they've grabbed other people. I mean, yeah, the tiny box is very appealing. I'm not going to deny that. and I'll happily play it again. I don't know that I've got a tremendous drive to go back to it, but it was enjoyable. That is The White Castle Matcha, designed by Israel Sendrero and Sheila Santos, published by Devir Games. Finally, we played Planet Unknown with the new Supermoon expansion. This is something I just got from crowdfunding.
Supermoon! I think isn't that how it's pronounced? I think it is.
Yes, it is named in commemoration of that time when I let my belt get too loose. And I was very excited about the Supermoon expansion because I've got a lot of enthusiasm for Planet Unknown. It's a polyomino playing game with a Lazy Susan. First point of contention. First objection. I don't know if this is something I've missed. If I've missed, please send a comment down below or send us an email. They call it a Lazy Susan. This is a sci-fi game from which you are taking your polyomino tiles. The leader gets to orient the Lazy Susan however they want and take one of the tiles in front of them, and then everyone has to take one of the ones in front of them. Susan is an acronym. They have not explained what it's for. We take acronyms very seriously here at So Very Wrong About Games. I think that part has been made eminently clear from the way we talk about things and the way we label our segments. If you're going to have an acronym, it doesn't have to be an acronym. It could have just been Lazy Susan, but no, it's Susan, an acronym. What does it stand for? What's your secret? Adam's Apple Games, let us know. What are you hiding?
Spill it.
Yeah, give us the tea. Like they said in the Matcha expansion, give us the tea. Anyway, so that's one issue I've had since the beginning of Planet Unknown. But one issue that I've had with Planet Unknown since the beginning is I've often gotten the sense that the individual pieces don't necessarily fit terribly well together. It's like the criticism I leveled against the specific interaction we had with Massive Darkness. It's like the criticism I've had with the way the various modules work in Thunder Alley. You know, all these individual bits are cool, and you definitely want more toys as opposed to fewer toys in some contexts, but you start to worry that maybe they didn't think too hard about how these things would interact. And I definitely felt this way about how some of the objectives work, definitely felt that way about a lot of the events, felt that way about a lot of the asymmetric planets, and so the only part of Planet Unknown that I could really get behind were the asymmetric corporations. Were they balanced? I don't know. I don't really care. But at least they were cool. And they let me play with some fun toys. And then every once in a while, I'd introduce like sort of an ad hoc house rule, like how one player got stuck with two effectively contradictory goals. Like you want lots of tech tiles with the competition with the player to your left, but the player to your right, you want very few numbers of tech tiles. So just as a house rule, like, okay, well, let's just shove that objective over so that no one's juggling those two competing impulses. Not that I don't like competing impulses, but when those conflicts exist for Louis, but not for me, I have two complementary objectives and some people at the table don't, that's not great. Anyway, so I don't know what I was expecting with the expansion. I'd already had some indication that there might be some dodgy design work at work. I cannot remember the last time I have hated an expansion as much as I hated Supermoon. I didn't hate playing with Supermoon, but the extent to which it was less enjoyable than the base game was considerable.
It's what it represented, Mark.
It's what it stands for.
Yeah, it was interesting. It takes all the tightness of not being able to place a tile or where you can place tiles to like just giving you a dumping ground where it's like, oh, I'll just throw it up there this turn and then, you know. So there's a little moon grid where you can put tiles. You sort of want to make sure you pick ones that don't have meteors on them because meteors are bad up there. It has this death laser that goes around. It just seems all sort of abstract and weird. And then, yeah, it takes that sort of that whole pressure is now gone.
Yeah, it was the case in previous games of Planet Unknown that some people would be further along in covering their planets than others because of various trade-offs and considerations they've made. We all ended with very similar boards, namely almost completely full, both the supermoon and the core planet that we're terraforming. And consequently, it took a long time. We played like almost 2 hours of Planet Unknown. Planet Unknown cannot suffer that. Like, it was a breezy game, 75 minutes or so. It does not bear the extra length very well at all. And so consequently, the decisions were less interesting and there were more of them. And that is setting aside the fact that there were tons of weird interaction with, you know, again, every individual piece that you choose to play with, there's more opportunity for weird nonsense to accrue. So if you're playing with asymmetric planets, that's another set of things that it's not juggling very well. If you play with events, not going to be juggled very well. I'll just everything that would happen, every new Civ card that I looked at, every new element that was introduced because it's a modular expansion in the context of Supermoon, I was unimpressed and made me want to just go back to the regular base game.
Yeah, also you made us think that if certain combos would arise, that it would just break the game as well. It's like, well, if this event came up with this particular power, how would that even interact? It would make no sense anyway.
Yeah, there was a Civ card that gave bonus points for bio patches, which are just these single individual tiles that you sometimes get as a benefit for going up a certain track. And Huey's asymmetric corporation lets him spit out bio patches like nobody's business. He had easily five times as many as anybody else. And so when Louis played that Civ card, it's like, okay, well, I went through the cards and this is the one that I want. Huey looked over and said, wow, if I got that, that would be worth a tremendous amount of points. Like, yeah, was this an intentional interaction? I doubt it. I doubt it very sincerely. So not a positive impact on the game. And one might, a cynic might choose to associate this week's topic with our having played Supermoon.
Yeah, that's a bad reach right there. It definitely has nothing
to do with it. Conspirational thinking. Yeah.
Those are the games we played this week. Now a quick break while we pay some bills.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
And we're back with the news and why it doesn't matter. Mark, we both like Bullet. Bullet is getting a big box with 2 new expansions. We should play more Bullet.
Should we? I think it's okay. We also don't have Bullet.
Mark, we should get Bullet.
Okay. Yeah, Bullet's the real-time puzzle game by Level 99 Games. I thought it was vaguely cute. I just could never find a gameplay mode that really made the mechanism sing. I mean, the multiplayer versus is kind of where it's at, but even then there was some rockiness. So a fair number of good ideas, though. And as far as puzzles go, I found it inoffensive.
I loved how every player had their own sort of asymmetric power and how their sort of board would work.
Yeah, thematically, it was supposed to be a representation of shoot 'em up games. But functionally, it just ended up feeling like a weird, like, Tetris variant, which is fine. It was very transparently the case. Like, when I sat down to play for the first time, I wasn't surprised. It was clear from the rule set.
But if you like Bullet and hate how there's so many boxes, well, now it'll be a big box.
So much Bullet. Benjamin Sperling, off of publishing Pride and Prejudice, the Pride and Prejudice Roll'n'Write, has followed up with, I think, Jane Austen's most underappreciated work, Persuasion. So this is going to be a 1 or 2 player roll-and-write print-and-play game about Persuasion. I am very enthusiastic. I will be backing. This is up on crowdfunding right now. If you enjoy Persuasion, as I do, if you enjoy roll-and-writes, you might want to give it a shot. This is Benny Sperling's Persuasion, up on Kickstarter now.
Mark loves Champions of Midgard, so I'm happy to announce that it is getting a 10th anniversary edition.
Yay.
So those people who don't have the swag number one game of the century, now is your chance. It doesn't look like they're changing too much. Hopefully they'll be maybe...
Why mess with perfection?
Exactly. I'm sure I enjoy Champions of Midgard.
I know, and it causes me to have serious questions about you.
So I'm sure there'll be some like fancy stuff you can get to upgrade your game, even though it's been fairly upgraded already. More Champions of Midgard stuff.
For the record, I think Midgard's fine. It's just kind of dull. Finally, we don't have a whole lot of information about it now, and absolutely more information will come to follow. We are going to be taking this seriously. We're going to have policies. We're going to make sure that there are accessibility policies. We're going to make sure that there are safety policies, etc. But we can tell you to save the date. There's going to be a convention. It doesn't even have a title yet. We might end up calling it SwagCon. My tentative idea in my head is to call the So Very Wrong About Games Fun Times, Good Vibes Only Trans Rights or Human Rights Board Game Jamboree. Again, it really rolls off the tongue. I think that's a very simple way of conferring. We will be getting together in Kingston, Ontario, July 25th, 26th, and 27th to play board games. We're not going to have a lot of fancy nonsense, but we're going to play board games. We're not going to be selling you stuff. We're going to play some board games. So we have a hall. We have a location. We will be having more policies later. We're just saying, reserve the date, start considering travel options. We will be having more to follow in the coming weeks. That is a convention for So Very Wrong About Games, July 25th, 26th, and 27th of this year.
And that is the news, and why it doesn't matter. Now on to the topic of the week, which is why expansions fail.
Well, how they can fail. I mean, like, why expansions fail seems to imply, Walker, that expansion, like, you're saying that expansions just fail, that they're all bad. No, some of them are good.
Some of them are good.
I mean, Macho was pretty good.
It's true.
Apparently, Walker, despite the fact that he cut his teeth on Fantasy Flight Games, notorious for being unplayable before the first expansion, now he hates them all.
All right. I put this in at the last minute, and I think it is the number one reason.
Okay, all right.
I'm pretty sure it is pretty straight up multimedia. Yeah, multimedia. Board Game Geek, forums, emails, Facebook, the designer / producer sees these suggestions and or complaints from such a small percentage of the players, and therefore they think something needs to be fixed, something needs to be added, there is something wrong with their base game, and so they make expansions.
I don't think so.
Or how they make the expansion is to fix these illusionary pretend problems, and therefore the expansion's not as good as it could be because they're relying on multimedia.
Do you have any evidence for this or just vibes?
There's just too much to go through.
Too much evidence, no time.
Yep.
Just have to, okay.
It's vibes. Yes.
I think that more often the case, my sort of cynical overall gloss for why a lot of expansions are perhaps unsatisfying are because the game didn't need an expansion and they figure they're leaving money on the table, so why not? And there's a good faith attempt to make more content for a game, and they try to make it as good as possible. They try to either identify a problem to solve or identify a new feature to add, but it ends up just being a perfunctory cash grab. That would be my cynical, uninformed, unenlightened
generalization. Yeah, I have that down here as well, and because that feeds into the crowdfunding, right? Because it happens all the time. They're putting out a second edition, or they want to run a second run, and so they tack on an expansion to bring back the original people.
Can I issue a very specific complaint? This has been under my skin for a while. I haven't talked about it thus far, but I feel like I have to talk about it now. Ascendancy. All right? Ascendancy fulfilled weeks ago, and I've been trying to get it to the table, mostly out of a sense of perfunctory obligation. It's a first-time crowdfunding project by a dude who goes by the pseudonym Matthew Meeple. It's probably, I'm not going to speculate as to its merits. Regardless of its merits, the way it's presented its rules already angered me on a number of levels. It was like, okay, well, look into this book, and the first two pages of this book about are all this. This is my dream project. This is the one that I always want with no compromises cut, blah, blah, blah. Thank you for this journey. I'm like, yeah, fine. Save that verbiage for the back of the rulebook. And then it's like, okay, look at this rulebook. Look at this other setup rulebook. This other setup rulebook tells me to go look deeper into the setup rulebook. Oh, wait, that table's missing. I don't know where it is. Okay, go back to the first rulebook. Oh, on the cover of this, there's some badly CGI'd titties. Okay, so I was already in bad mood. All right? And I've been trying good faith. I've been setting it up. It's on my table. We're in the process run. Now, they're doing the standard expansion plus reprint crowdfunding right now for Ascendancy. And they're saying, this is the version of the game that I originally wanted. And I'm like, dude, I already had to read your two pages gushing about how this is your dream project and this is the game you always wanted. And now you're telling me, no, that wasn't the game that I always wanted. This is the game you always... Before I said that was the game I always wanted, but now I want more money. And now you tell... Now by the expansion, so it's the game I always wanted. This is so minor, and it does not deserve this amount of spleen, but I've been wrestling with these rule books and this incomplete merry-go-round chase of a red herring series of nonsense. And now the blurb, the self-congratulatory emotional disgorgement at the front of the rule book, it turns out it was either a lie or a setup for another bit of a lie.
The diner says that what you have is garbage.
No, that's a bit further. But it's just, if you're going to tell... I feel like my time was wasted and or I've been misled. Moving on. So the most common... Okay, can I complain about my most common type of failed expansion?
Yes.
The one that you forget about and never interact with. It's the one that's over there.
Oh, yes.
I call it the over there problem. It's the new board. It's the new track. It's the new thing. And then you're like, oh, yeah, that thing. Oh, How does that work again? Okay.
I have something about that. It's like something just... And now there's too much stuff. Yeah, it's...
It's not even that there's too much. It's true. Just that it's either spatially or visually or mentally just over there, and so nobody touches it. So I've got a couple of examples of this, even from games that I like, even from expansions that I overall kind of sort of like. So Voyages of Marco Polo, you can have the expansion where you have the new Venice board, and it's literally just like, well, you could be playing the game over here the way, or there's this other weird Venice thing. And a lot of people just ignore it, and I understand why. Anachrony. We love a lot of the expansion material in Anachrony, and a lot of it's even worth the extra effort. But the problem is, with the Fractures expansion, it has another board which is sufficiently good that you want to go and interact with the board. But it also introduces this new deck of cards, and that new deck of cards is definitely, for us at least, the one thing that's too far. You go and pay some gold, and it's kind of... sometimes it's a new power, sometimes it's a new scoring condition. It's the one thing too far, and generally speaking, people ignore the crap out of it. And it's just... That's one of the ways in which expansions can be completely superfluous. It's just the one extra thing, and no one touches it.
The other thing is sort of the same thing, where it's the flow. The flow is so good. Like, let's say they added an expansion to Fromage, which tacked on something else that would happen during the turn that would just, you know, bog it down. And it also happens in Scythe, you know, when you add the airships. It's just like that one thing. Like, Scythe flows so nicely, and then you start tacking on these extra things that speed bump the game down and change how the game is played and just ruins the whole experience.
So too much can mean a number of different things. Yeah, too much can definitely ruin the flow. Too many details can definitely overwhelm something, even when it's slightly more cohesive. So an example I'll use, this is a super obscure example. There's a game called Bushido Der Weg des Kriegers, which was published in German only, but you can get the English rulebook. I am fascinated with this design. It is super weird. It's kind of sort of a troops on a map game, but it's also a role selection game. And you never control your own armies. The idea is that you can be the daimyo, and you say, look, you, Huey, go attack Louis for me with my troops. And there's this weird set of fascinating interlocking incentives so that Huey isn't inclined to throw the fight, but sometimes he might have to. It's really cool. But one of the biggest problems is that you can end up with really crappy territories. And so they decided to address that in the expansion, Ten and the Stranger. And that's the really good part. The really core good part is you can start improving your territories, and the opportunity cost for doing so is much, much lower if you have crap. The problem is it also introduces a couple of new phases, a whole bunch of new special powers, an entire new bag of tiles, and it takes a game that was already relatively rules-heavy into something that's hugely rules-burdensome. But, and this is another aspect of the too much expansion, all the components need to be set up in a specific way and organized in a specific way if you're going to be playing with the expansion. And so you have to decide whether you're going to keep them separate or not. And so you can't just go back and forth. Anyway, it's kept it from the table for many years as a consequence.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And I've talked about this many times, keeping it from the table, because you take down the box.
Yeah.
You open up the lid and you look in and you see like the 42 different modules and you wonder which ones you should play with. Or... Yep. You could put the lid back on the box and grab a different game.
Well, that's another category. That's the too many. Yeah. Some games you can expand effectively infinitely and it's okay. Like Mass of Darkness, for example.
Yes.
You can have an infinite number of different heroes. They're not going to be well balanced, but that's fine. It's a co-op dice chucking game. Who cares? You can have an infinite number of different classes because you just have to learn how your class works and there you go. You're off to the races. Same thing with Root. You can have infinite number of Root factions.
Or monsters for Mass of Darkness. More monsters. Add more characters.
Exactly.
Sentinels of the Multiverse. Throw in as many villains, as many heroes you want. More stuff in that type of game. Always better.
100%. But then there's the module trap. Like the example that I like to give is Clinic. Clinic by Albaviar has so many modules. And one gets the sense, for me, it's not even just the material burden of, you know, looking there. It's, as you say, it's the mental burden. Like, so what version are we going to play now?
They have a deck of cards for that, Mark. There's an entire deck of cards, one for each module, so you could shuffle it up and deal out as many as you like.
Yeah,
there's
a whole that's a boon.
There's a whole campaign book that will slowly introduce all of the modules.
Honestly,
there's so many.
I know. That's a godsend, though. How many expansions deep was he before he introduced those things? At least double digits.
Yes, for sure. Oh, yes.
And I start to worry and wonder about the editorial choices being made here. And I'd like to have a little bit of guidance. It's like bad scenario design. So, like, Now, just to be clear, this is not the problem we have with Supermoon. Supermoon is also a modular expansion to Planet Unknown. There's not a huge number of different modules, and even credit where credit is due, they say if you play with Module A, you should probably also play with Module B. They kind of sort of work together. I'm like, good, that's fine. A little bit of guidance, ain't no thing. The problems with Supermoon are different. But yeah, some expansions can have too much. Some expansions don't have to worry about that. And indeed, number of different modules is, I think, a paradigmatic example.
And sometimes it's not always the flow it'll interrupt, it'll be the tightness. You've already brought up Marco Polo 2. Marco Polo with the Venice expansion.
Yeah, yeah.
And what that also did is just it made the game a lot looser.
Yes.
It introduced much more money, much more stuff, where Marco Polo was like so tight and cutthroat, and that opened it wide up.
Yeah, and sometimes, the opposite can be true. This is an example of an expansion that I don't think fails, like Matcha, for example. If after expanding it, it's still tight, or indeed, if you expand it and you're just very, very conscious of these things, like the way the Norwegians did for Feast for Odin, that's an example of how you can preserve or lean into the strengths, or even just modify the strengths without undercutting it. Yeah, a number of expansions. This was my critique also of the Barrage expansion, the League Water Project, which is fascinating. This is a broader category, though, and I'd like to hear your thoughts, because there's something in common with Barrage, and you talked about this in the context of Unconscious Minds and in the context of purportedly the way Ascendancy was designed. This idea that we designed an incredibly complex game and then pared it down for the initial release. But the way you're supposed to play it, the ideal version, is with the expansion involved, right? Either the publisher or the designers themselves said, no, take 20% off the top and chop it off for a module. I prefer Barrage without the League Water Project, even though the designers intend that to be the version of the game. That was originally the only way to play Barrage before it was sundered. I like the sundering because it makes the placement really tight and focused. League Water, I think, loosens it a little bit too much. And you commented something similar about Unconscious Minds, because you felt that it was already too much.
Yes.
And that there were a whole bunch of other modules that you didn't even touch. But that's the way you're supposed to play.
That's what people have said, that the only way to play Conscious Mind properly is to play with all of the modules. And when I was reading a bunch of stuff about this, there's lots of reasons why they do, like, to bring down the cost of the game. That they purposely cut out entire parts of the game and make it an expansion later on, which, might take away from the game. I do have a line here for this where parts of the game aren't being engaged with the way the designer wanted to.
Yeah.
Like, because once the game's released, there's so many more, hundreds of thousands of plays. It's like, well, they're not interacting with this part the way I wanted them to, so they bring out an expansion. Or maybe the publisher or the developer thought they knew what they were doing when they looked at this game before it was published, and they hacked out a piece or they changed something that they really shouldn't
have.
Sorry,
developers? What are those?
Yeah, I know. Some people should really learn. And so,
I don't think it's a question of people need to learn. That was just a crack about crowdfunding.
And so, sometimes, because we've seen that where they've changed that. The designer will come out and say, well, I had no control over it after I gave them the design. They changed that whole thing. Here's how it should have been played, and here's an expansion that fixed it.
Yeah. One pet peeve that I have about expansions that can really undercut their strengths or even just undermine the core gameplay is they want to basically kind of sort of change the iconography, but not really. Like, the iconography used to work, but then you introduce a new resource, and then things get weird. Like, Matcha did a really good job with this, right? They gave you new player boards and all the original icons. They didn't say gain a resource of your choice. They show gain one of these three resources. The new resource isn't there, so that's not an option. So they appear to be consistent about the use of iconography. But so often, I made this complaint about the expansion Pearly Imperii for Res Arcana. Like, okay, pearls are a thing now. Anytime it says any resource in all these other cards that we have, that doesn't include pearls. And sometimes pearls can be used in exchange for this, but none of these other times. Like, oh. And sometimes it's those simplest distinctions and the simplest changes are the trickiest to do. Now, you can't just replace all the cards in Res Arcana. That's fine. But I appreciate it when expansions, as best as possible, include either new references or new consolidated references. Oh, geez. This is a bit of a discursion. Consolidate everything as much as possible. Like your player aids. If you're going to be including player aids, make it a consolidated player aid. Make it so that I don't have to fumble through three or four. If this is the expansion, give me a new all-in-one, please. Just give me a new comprehensive player aid.
The rest I have are just sort of silly ones. But still reasons nonetheless. Color matching.
Oh, jeez.
We just played a game recently that I couldn't remember what it was. Was it Massive Darkness 2?
No.
I just remember it was the backs of the cards were gray and black, and when we looked at the, they were like so completely different that it was bizarre. So anyway, when color matching doesn't work out, when an expansion comes out, it really makes things weird. And then there are so many third-party and or upgraded parts. Like I've already run into this problem with
Veil of Eternity. It was the Veil of Eternity expansion. The card backs were just very different.
That's what it was. And then, like I said, upgraded parts. I ran into this problem with Orleans, right? With the Plague expansion, you have upgraded parts from a third party.
Yep.
Now they don't match. Now you can't play it because, you know, you threw out the old parts. Screw those old parts.
Yeah, it's weird. On the one hand, I want to say, oh, well, you know, that's why, once again, early adopters get punished. This is true always and invariably, and expansions are no exception. It's like, oh, that's why you need to save your old components. It is liberating to be able to dispense with, like, keeping old components you're never going to use. If you have a huge collection, that's an act of madness. And so it is not reasonable for people to expect this. Like, I remember in particular, there was this was an example, a really, really terrible example. There were extra components in the first edition of Tribune. And there were extras because they needed five copies of everything. And so they just had two sets of punch boards of three each. So you had six of everything. I don't know why I kept the sixth of everything. But when the expansion came out a year later and said, oh, by the way, I hope you kept them because you need them now.
Oh, no, that's dirty pool.
It is
right
dirty
there.
Pool. Now, this is true of the earlier Heidelberger / Fantasy Flight version of Tribune. This is not true of the new Tribune by Spielworks, so don't worry about it. But, publishers, when publishing expansions, should not expect you to have kept...
There's another game that did that as well. There's like this whole sheet of upgrade tiles. I wish I could remember the game. Where, you know, it was all this sort of... Like, don't worry about those. What those are. Those are going to be upgrades for, you know, so hope you kept them. Because now here they are. Here's all the rules for them.
Yeah, it's rough. And But literally, when it came to the case of Orléans, you had a serious problem with those plague tokens because you had the improved discs. And I literally don't know what publishers should do in that instance because it's kind of a no-win situation. They want to partner and increase... really deluxe components for things because those are fun and you like those improved discs and they're cool. But at the same time, when they release the expansion, they can't necessarily already commit or have all much less already produced new deluxe versions of all the existing tokens. It's rough. Maybe no one should make expansions.
Exactly. More boxes. I hate extra boxes.
Yeah.
I hate when expansions don't fit in the main box. I have limited space.
But we also hate when the main box is too big.
Yeah, extra space in the main box. You know, they can't win, Mark. It's, you know, we're going to call them out on everything. So
it's possible we're just a couple of cranks.
It's true.
Have you considered that?
No.
Okay.
It's impossible.
All right. I was just talking crazy talk.
All right. I put a positive in here for some reason why they failed. I just like more player colors. In expansions. No, I think it's... No, that's what it was. It was the 5/6 player, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
the 5/6 player expansion.
Here you can play this very intense game with even more players.
Yes.
Because that won't throw the balance of stuff off at all, especially area control games.
They're at least...
here's you know, add more players. But the reason I like them...
it should be transparent to people. Like, you know what you're getting into. If you've played a game with three or four and you see the 5 or 6 player expansion, normally a somewhat experienced hobby gamer will know to avoid that if it's going to throw it out of whack.
Yeah, 99% of the time, I buy them anyway because it gives you more player colors
and
to choose
often
from.
Purple is one of them.
Exactly.
And Walker likes to play purple.
I do.
Yeah, reasonable.
And lastly, I have... This is just looking at the Upstairs collection.
Yes.
These are a list of the expansions or games that have expansions that have just been put in the box and not played yet.
Okay.
Bonfire, Gaia Project, Game of Thrones, Furnace, Isle of Skye 2 expansions, Nucleum 2 expansions, Rebellion 1 expansion, and Takenu still in shrink. So I don't know what that says about expansion. But it does say something.
Yeah, it says something. Well, very often this is part and parcel of a lot of the neuroses that we as hobbyist gamers associate, right? It is hard to disambiguate the buying of the game with the pleasures of playing games, right? So we often end up in the trap of thinking, well, if I buy more games, I'll play more games. It's like, no, that's actually not the way it works.
Oh, that was another point that came up too, right? Why buy expansions? Save the money and just buy a new game.
Well, I don't know. It's hard, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think to a certain extent, I don't think it's the best expansion ever, but I think that just an example of an expansion that doesn't do any of this nonsense is the Norwegians expansion for Feast for Odin, right? Because this was an expansion that sought to address issues with the base game in the most cohesive and straightforward and integrated way possible. It's like, all right, you're going to get an entirely new board. We're going to rejigger all the actions so that they make more sense. We're going to rebalance this. We're going to restructure that. And yeah, is it the most elegant way to do it? No, because it did introduce an entire new component tray of components. But nonetheless, they all made sense within the existing architecture of the game. And so to a certain extent, when I think of expansions that fail, a lot of them are just expansions that didn't work as smoothly as that.
Yes.
Although, again, the one that I find the most frustrating is the over there problem.
It's yeah. Like,
it's this extra thing, this other thing. We forget to interact with it. It's just over there. Maybe it's too much rules. Maybe it's not. But it's just, it's so hard.
Yeah, it's new. I don't like it.
Well, there's that too. I mean, just to close things out, another expansion that almost gets there but doesn't, and is subtly one more thing, but doesn't fall victim to the over-there problem to the same extent, in my experience, is Revive. The Revive expansion introduces a new track and a new deck of cards, but both because the track is directly adjacent to the existing track and because the way to get points in that track is just scattered around the main board anyway, it might be too much rules grit for a lot of people, and I can be completely sympathetic to that, but it is difficult to forget that it exists.
It's true. I am in my third game of Revive with the expansion, and I'm still not going up that victor point track.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that it's seamless for everybody. I think it is less seamful, or perhaps more seamless than a lot of other alternatives. That's all. Yeah, and my defenses of Revive most of the time are like that. It's like, look, it doesn't revolutionize the field of medium-heavy Euros. It's just more tightly integrated in terms of its scoring. Is it tightly integrated? No. It's, you know, it sprawls a little bit, but less so.
Yeah.
And I think my defense of the expansion is more or less in the same vein. So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate your deciding to have spend the time with us. As always, take care of yourselves. Self-care is an obligation you have. Take care of your hobby time, and thank your rules explainer. Bye, everyone.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Making financial decisions shouldn't feel like picking a TV show. Too many options, too much hype, and no way to know what's actually good. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast cuts through the clutter. Their finance journalists break through real-world money decisions with clear, research-backed insights. From investing to home buying to credit cards, the nerds help you navigate major financial decisions with confidence. Leave TV to fate. Leave your next financial move to the nerds. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.